love and patience. Not just the love that Jacob showed towards Rachel, but the love that God shows to all of us. It's a story of grace. God took this messed up family, this broken family, to be his chosen people, the ones who would demonstrate his love and goodness to the nations around them. And this is the family that God would ultimately use to show the greatest love of all time in their descendant, Jesus. It's a story that reminds us of God's grace. And it's his grace, not our human effort or our successes or our failures, which makes all the difference. This is just a snapshot into the life of this family. It started back with Abraham, back in Genesis chapter 12, and you'll have to read from there if you want to get the full context of the story. We're joining the story with a deceitful man who's made mistakes, but one to whom God will reveal himself several times. This is Jacob. He's a shepherd by trade, and he's running away from home after deceiving his mother and his twin brother with his mother's help. You can read their story in Genesis 27 and 28. He's running away and heading towards his uncle Laban's, his mother's brother. Before he can meet his uncle, he stops by a well and sees a beautiful young shepherdess. Finding out that she's his cousin, he's overjoyed. He kisses her and then bursts into tears. Rachel takes Jacob to meet her family. This is Jacob's uncle Laban with his daughters Leah and Rachel. Leah is the oldest, but rather plain looking. Rachel has a lovely figure and is very beautiful. Jacob falls in love with Rachel pretty quickly. After only knowing her for a month, he agrees to work for her father for 7 years in exchange for her hand in marriage. He loves Rachel so much that the time flies. It seems like only a few days because Rachel's there waiting at the end of it for him. If this was a film, we'd probably see lots of meaningful looks across fields, long walks, romantic sunsets, and the story would then end there with a happily ever after. But this is real life, and it didn't work out quite the way that Jacob had hoped for. The wedding day finally arrived. Laban greets friends and neighbours, inviting them to the wedding feast. Everyone enjoys eating and drinking. That night, as darkness falls, Jacob eagerly meets his heavily veiled bride to his tent. This is the moment that Jacob has worked for 7 years for. He's been dreaming about it, wondering about this moment. But his dream quickly turns into a nightmare when he wakes up the next morning to discover that his bride was not the beautiful Rachel, but her older, less attractive sister, Leah. Jacob furiously confronts Laban about the deception, conveniently forgetting the time that he deceived his own father. Laban calmly explains that this was not their custom to allow the younger daughter to marry before the older one. Jacob is seething, but it's too late to do anything about it. He reluctantly agrees to wait until the end of the bridal week with Leah before he marries Rachel too, in exchange for another 7 years of work for Laban. Now, some of the details surrounding the marriages of Jacob are a little bit vague, but whatever the specifics, we know that this was not a happy start to marriage for any of them. Now, I'm sure that not many of us have found ourselves in this exact situation, but I'm sure that we've all experienced the repercussions of deception and lies, either those that we've told to others or those that have been told to us. Whenever we seek to deceive others, the truth always comes out in the end with damaging consequences. How often are we tempted to deceive or lie to others because we think it's easier, or we think it's more convenient or more profitable than telling the truth? But ultimately, lies only lead to destruction and broken relationships. The truth may be harder and more inconvenient initially, but leads to healing and trust. As Laban did, we have a choice. Will we try to find the easy way out with lies? Or will we choose to be honest, no matter how difficult it might be? The consequences of Laban's deception are that Leah, wanting desperately to be loved by her husband, is instead hated. Jacob didn't want to be stuck with her in the first place, and Rachel is jealous that she has to share her husband with her sister. Leah also has to deal with the fact that she's been given away by her father to someone who doesn't want her. She feels alone and rejected. But God sees and knows Leah's situation and blesses her with children. Rachel has known for the last 7 years that Jacob loves her and intended to marry her. She'd probably spent that time dreaming about her new life as his wife, mentally arranging their new home, decorating it, filling it with lovely furniture, wondering what their children would look like. But she probably didn't daydream about the fact that she'd be sharing her husband with her sister. A seed of jealousy is sown. And it begins to grow when Leah starts to have children. First Reuben, then Simeon, followed by Levi, then Judah. Eventually, Rachel's jealousy gets to the point where she can't keep it in anymore, and she takes it out on Jacob. "Give me children or I'll die!" She's quite dramatic. Jacob, instead of being sympathetic, is furious with her. "Am I God? He's the one who stopped you from having children." Now, Rachel's solution is to give her maid Bilhah to Jacob in the hope that her maid can bear children on her behalf. The plan works. Bilhah gives birth first to Dan and then to Naphtali. But now Leah notices that she stopped having children and decides to copy her sister. She gives her maid Zilpah to give to Jacob, who gives birth to Gad and Asher. After that, Leah gives birth again to Issachar, Zebulun, and Jacob's only daughter, Dinah. And eventually, after years of waiting, God answers Rachel's prayers, and she gives birth to Joseph. Now, just imagine that you're Rachel. You're young, you're beautiful, you're loved by your husband, you're married to somebody you can trust, your future is safe because you have a husband. Your servant has given birth to two sons on your behalf, and you've just given birth to a much longed-for son yourself. There's much to thank God for. And yet it seems that Rachel struggled to be grateful. The names of her children tell us a lot about the state of her heart. With Dan, she finally feels that she has proven herself worthy to be a wife. It's almost as if she doesn't justify the title of wife until she's able to give her husband children. She's longing to be loved, but feels that she has to earn that love, not recognizing that Jacob already loves her. With Naphtali, she says, "I've had a great struggle with my sister, and I've won." You can really see the competition between her and Leah. She's so jealous. She can't be happy for her sister, but carries bitterness in her heart. And with Joseph, she says, "God has taken away my disgrace. May the Lord add to me another son." Now, there is a glimmer of gratitude here. She recognizes that God has blessed her with a son, that she no longer feels the disgrace of being childless. But it still seems she's not entirely satisfied. She longs for at least one more son. And now imagine that you're Leah. You've always lived in the shadow of your beautiful younger sister. She's often had the attention of men, but you've always been overlooked. You were essentially sold off by your father to a man you knew didn't want you. Since your marriage, you've lived with the fact that your husband hates you and that your sister is jealous of you. There seems to be very little to thank God for. And yet Leah was grateful to God. The names of some of her children tell us about the state of her heart. With Reuben, Leah recognizes that even though she was overlooked by most people, she was not overlooked by God. With Simeon, she still doesn't feel loved by her husband, but she knows that God hears her. And with Judah, she praises the Lord and chooses his name to reflect that. Leah's life was far from perfect. She felt rejection from those around her who should have loved her. The names of some of her other children reveal the longing that she had in her heart to be loved by her husband. But Leah grew to know and depend on her husband's God because she had no one else to turn to. She was grateful to him for her children. Envy and jealousy didn't help Rachel. Rachel's envy of Leah made no difference to her childlessness. Being envious didn't help her to have children. It just made her bitter and ruined whatever relationship there had been with her sister. How often do we fall into the trap of focusing on what we don't have instead of being grateful for the things that God has blessed us with? Yes, life is often far from our idea of perfect. There will be plenty of times when we're hurt, disappointed, let down, rejected by those that we seek to love. It's easy to let bitterness in. And once it's in, it can be very hard to get rid of. But remember this, the bitter heart eats its owner. Holding on to bitterness does nothing more than destroy the person hosting the bitterness. It's like a parasite, invisible from the outside, but doing great damage on the inside. And it's almost impossible to deal with alone. If you recognize that bitterness has taken hold in your life, simply trying to get rid of it is unlikely to work. It may keep its head down for a little while. You may think that you've dealt with it, but it will pop up again when you least expect it. The best way to deal with bitterness is to take it to God, to admit to him how you feel about a person or a situation, to allow him to deal with it. It also helps to talk with somebody else who will pray for you and help you to get rid of the bitterness. We have a choice to make in those times when life is less than perfect. Will we allow bitterness to grow in our hearts, to take hold, to ruin our relationships? Or will we choose to thank God for the many blessings that he gives us each day, knowing that he will help us and sustain us through all that life throws at us? I can't help but feel that Rachel's life would have been very different if she had learned to put aside her bitterness and develop a relationship with God. But moving on with the story. After Jacob has worked off his time for Rachel, a total of 14 years, Jacob agrees to keep on working for Laban. His wages now will be any of the spotted, streaked, speckled goats or any of the dark-coloured lambs. Jacob works for another 6 years, but after a total of 20 years of working for Laban, Jacob has had enough. Laban keeps changing his wages and treating him unfairly. So after hearing from God, Jacob decides to head back to his father's land. But he decides to sneak away rather than telling Laban that they're going. Another deception. When Jacob tells Rachel and Leah of his plan, they're in total agreement for a change. They feel that their father has sold them into this marriage and that he's used up all of that money. There is no inheritance left for them or their children. Now, Jacob and Laban are not the only devious members of this family. Rachel, most likely feeling angry and hurt at her father's treatment, decides to steal his household gods before they leave. To cut a long story short, Laban finds out about the missing gods, chases after Jacob and his family, and ransacks their camp looking for them. Rachel is pretty sneaky and is able to hide them before her dad finds her, and Laban never finds out where his gods are. After some harsh words and accusations on both sides, Laban and Jacob make an agreement to leave each other alone before Laban returns home. The next challenge on their journey is that they come to the land where Jacob's twin brother Esau lives. They didn't part well, and Jacob is worried about Esau's reaction to seeing him. After praying, he decides to pacify his brother with gifts. He sends groups of animals on ahead to Esau with the message that these are gifts from his brother Jacob. Jacob is still fearful of Esau's reaction and decides to split his family up for their own protection. The maidservants and their children go ahead first. Leah and her children come next. And Rachel and Joseph are at the back. Again, Jacob shows his greater love for Rachel by putting her in the place of greatest safety. Thankfully, 20 years' distance seems to have healed some of the hurt, Jacob and Esau are reunited. Esau lets Jacob pass through unharmed and even offers protection on the rest of their journey. A few years later, Rachel becomes pregnant again. But she has a difficult labour, and the midwife tries to reassure her. "Don't worry, it's another boy." But Rachel knows that she's dying. With her last breath, she names him Ben-Oni, meaning son of my trouble. But Jacob later renames him as Benjamin, son of my right hand. Jacob buries her somewhere between Bethel and Bethlehem, setting up a pillar to mark her tomb. So, what can we learn from Rachel's life? Do you remember the quote that we looked at earlier? She was messed up. So was her family. But look at what God did through them. Thankfully, God doesn't choose perfect people to fulfill his plans. If he did, we'd all be stuffed. He takes messed up, broken, damaged people who get things wrong and make bad choices. Isn't that an encouragement? No matter what your past is like, no matter what mistakes you've made, no matter what bad choices you've made, no matter what awful things other people have done to you, God loves you and has a purpose for your life. Don't ever think that you're beyond God's help. He can bring great things from the darkest of places. On the surface, Rachel's doesn't seem to be a story that ends with a happily ever after. But more than 700 years later, she was seen to be a blessing. At the end of the book of Ruth, who we heard about last week, we see Boaz arranging his marriage to Ruth with the elders of the town. They say to him, "May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel." I think Rachel would have been pretty surprised to hear her name as part of a blessing. I would guess that she didn't feel blessed a lot of the time. She was betrayed by her father. She had a damaged relationship with her sister. Her self-esteem must have been broken by the fact that she couldn't have children for so long. She didn't seem to recognize that actually she was part of a bigger plan. A plan that had begun with Abraham, Jacob's grandfather. God had made a promise to him. "I will multiply your descendants beyond number, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies, and through your descendants all the nations of the earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me." Jacob and Rachel and Leah and their messed up family were part of that ongoing promise. God's covenant with their family wasn't broken just because they were. Although Rachel must have been told the story of God talking with Father Abraham, it seems that she didn't recognize her part in fulfilling God's plan. She also didn't get to see the next part of the big picture, the things that would happen after her life and as a result of her marriage to Jacob. She didn't get to see Joseph grow up. She didn't get to see him sold into slavery, which I'm sure would have broken her heart. She didn't see God put him in a position of great power to save their family during a severe famine. She didn't see how she, along with her sister Leah, would be used to build up the family of Israel. God had a plan for her life. She and her family were going to be used by him even after her death to show his love and power to the nations around them at the time and to us today. We too may not feel like we're very blessed. Life might be hard. We might not always feel that God has a purpose for us. But like Rachel, we have no idea of how we fit into God's big picture. We don't know how our small actions can impact on the people around us. Like the story that Nick told us at the beginning of the service about Edward Kimball, I'm sure that he didn't realise how his small action of going into that shoe shop would affect so many millions of people. I had a friend at secondary school who had always been to church in her village with her family. She believed in God for as long as she could remember. But it was just something she did every week, rather than something that was real to her personally. One day, she came to church at Coombe Street, which is where we used to meet, and was struck by how happy everybody looked. She realised that she had to make a decision to follow God and actually do something about it. So she started reading the Bible and praying. She dates her conversion from that first time that she came to Coombe Street. What I didn't realise until years later when she told me is that I was the one who had invited her to church. I don't remember inviting her. It seems something very unlike what I would have done. It's not memorable to me. It hasn't made a big impression on my life. But God used my small and forgettable action as something to, as part of somebody else's journey to know him. We've already seen that Rachel didn't have a happily ever after. She seems to have spent most of her life in competition with her sister, feeling like the lesser wife because she couldn't provide sons for her husband. The irony is, she was loved more by her husband than her sister was. She didn't recognise the love that was offered to her and continued to try to earn Jacob's love in ways that just weren't helpful. But how often do we do the same thing? God offers us his love, but we can often fall into one of two traps. Either we think we're good enough and actually we deserve his love, or we recognise that we're not good enough and assume that we have to earn it in some way. But thankfully, the Bible tells us a different story. It tells us that everybody has sinned. We all fall short of God's glorious standard. It tells us that none of us are good enough. That every single person who has lived selfishly and has failed to live the life that God wants. And if we left it there, we'd have a good reason to feel helpless. We could try desperately to earn God's love. We could give to charity. We could turn up at church every week. We could do good things and live a good life. But we'd still end up feeling frustrated and hopeless when we failed at our attempts. The good news is that God knows we can't be good enough, but he fixed it. When we were utterly helpless, Christ came just at the right time and died for us sinners. Now, most people would not be willing to die for an upright person, though someone might perhaps be willing to die for a person who is especially good. But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners. And since we've been made right in God's sight by the blood of Christ, he will certainly save us from God's condemnation. For since our friendship with God was restored by the death of his son while we were still his enemies, we will certainly be saved through the life of his son. So now we can rejoice in our wonderful new relationship with God because our Lord Jesus Christ has made us friends of God. Jesus, a descendant of Jacob and his messed up family, lived a perfect life, died a perfect death, and came back to life. This enables us to know God's love no matter how messed up we are. God's love is freely offered to us, just as Jacob's love was freely offered to Rachel. And again, we have a choice to make. Do we act like Rachel, trying to earn God's love on our own terms? Or do we accept the gift that God has offered us, knowing that we'll never be able to pay him back, and living our lives in gratitude to him?
Thank you, Laura. And that question, I suppose, is quite a potent, strong question. We have that choice to accept God's love, and that doesn't stop from when we initially accept God's love. As I find in my life, it's an ongoing choice, maybe a daily choice or a weekly choice, of knowing that God died for us, gave Jesus for us freely, that he loves us with all his heart. I'm just going to spend some time now just to reflect. Are we living in that knowledge that we freely do have God's love, or are we trying to earn it through our actions over the past coming weeks? So I'm just going to spend a few minutes quietly just focusing on talking to God and just viewing our own hearts and see what God has to say to us. and then I will close in prayer.